Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a poison conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Poisoned, as in many kids, have been poisoned by fentanyl rather than overdose. Some parents of these victims don't believe their child overdosed because they did not intend to use fentanyl or take too much fentanyl. The kids thought they were buying Xanax or oxycodone and dropped dead. They were tricked. They were murdered. They were poisoned. In many cases, the drug dealer utilizes social media to facilitate the deadly sale. What responsibilities should social media companies have in these drug poisoning deaths? What should they be doing to stop social sales of drugs? To learn more about being poisoned by fentanyl, I reached out to Amy Neville. Amy Neville is the president of Alexander Neville Foundation, ANF, an organization her family founded after the tragic loss of her 14-year-old son, Alexander. A drug dealer on Snapchat convinced Alex to buy a pill that killed him. This heartbreaking experience pushed Amy to dive deeply into understanding the fentanyl crisis and the role social media plays in it. Amy has shared her family's stories and insights on CNN, Fox, CBS, ABC, and now on the High Truths podcast. To learn more about Amy Neville and Alexander's story, check out the High Truths show notes. I recorded this conversation with Amy on July 18th, 2025. This is my last recording before pausing High Truths as I prepare for a position at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Until then, I hope you enjoy this podcast, and I hope to bring you more High Truths. Amy Neville, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've been waiting to meet you and get to know you better, and I thought we would start with Alexander. Can you tell us about your son?
Sure. Alexander was a brilliant, intense, incredible 14-year-old kid. He was super duper smart, loved to learn about the world around him, had the best smile, always hear from friends every now and then about how much they miss his giggle. When he would laugh, he would just giggle really hard, and it was always so cute and funny and so innocent. At the time he died, he was just losing those baby cheeks, the little chunky cheeks. He was starting to get his man face, I guess, if you will. And his voice had changed, and it was deeper. And he loved to talk to his dad and I about a lot of things that were going on in his life. And he and his sister were really close. They were the best of friends and the worst enemies, you know, as you could probably imagine, at being 2 years apart. And it's left a huge hole in our life.
Yeah. What did he want to tell us about his final days? What did he think he was taking, or what happened to him?
So I'll tell you. So Alex, we've always thought we were parents in the know. We were prepared for the experimental phase. You know, Alex was a curious kid who was into trying things, whether it be food or skateboard tricks or whatever. Crazy roller coasters. He didn't have that sense of fear, if you will. And
his frontal lobe wasn't done growing.
Well, exactly. Right. So he liked to experiment with whatever it was. And so we really anticipated this kid would have an experimental phase. And so we were very open and talking about these things. And, as he got older, those conversations became more and more mature. And lo and behold, there's a funky few days in June of 2020 where things were just really off with him. And so I asked him, I'm like, are you using something? Like, what are you doing? I want to take you to the doctor. No, mom, I'm fine. I was up late. I ate something bad. And of course, 14, hyperpuberty, the moodiness was totally on par for his personality. And so I let it go that day. But he did come back to us like a day and a half later and said, okay, I got to talk to you guys. And he poured his heart out to us that night. And the key things out of that were I wanted to experiment with Oxy. I got it from a dealer on Snapchat. It has a hold on me and I don't know why. We didn't know about fentanyl at that time. And, you know, we did what any parent would do. We, that following morning, I called a treatment place to see what we could do to get him in. And they needed to call me back with their recommendation. That night he died. Like, I heard from them 4 minutes after his time of death. I got a call from them. And I will never know what that message said. I've since deleted it. And probably about a year ago, I finally deleted it and never listened to it because what good is it going to do me now, right? So yeah, that's how we learned about fentanyl.
Wow. So I mean, there's this theory about, you know, the river, upstream and downstream. And downstream is poisoning, overdose, dying from fentanyl, or even being upstream from that is being rescued with naloxone. And I think upriver from that is drug initiation. The most common drug that I see people starting with before they get to fentanyl is marijuana. And upstream from marijuana is mental health. Do you think that that applies to Alex?
I think that, yes, marijuana was where things started. And that was something we were dealing with in our household that I thought we were handling that. But I think that gave him a connection to this dealer on Snapchat who eventually offered him something more. And that's where that impact was, right? Yeah. And then as far as mental health, Alex has always been an intense kid, but he's not a kid that would have gone to a dark, scary place to get something like that. You know, if you think like when we were growing up, I'm 52, right? So people really weren't doing drugs in middle school. I mean, Alex didn't make it to high school. But middle school, that kind of thing wasn't on my radar. In high school, you knew where people were going to do those things. And it wasn't out in the open. It wasn't a drug dealer in their pocket, in their bedroom, in the middle of the night that had access to people. And so that has been the big shift. And that is why we are seeing these younger kids dying. And so quickly in the process is because these folks have access to them through these platforms, and these platforms are not doing anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your phone becomes the drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can I ask you, how's your family doing now?
How are we doing? It's such a weird thing to say.
You're never over it.
You're never over it. We're doing fine. We're doing fine. Like I always tell people when they ask how I'm doing, like, look, I'm a self-described happy, sad person. Those two things can exist at the same time within me. There's times where I'm crying and laughing at the same time because we're remembering something joyful but then it's upsetting, like I'm getting upset right now because that person's not here. And there's so much love that is left to give. And I think that's, where the advocacy and education work comes in. But my daughter's, getting ready to go to college. And so we're working on, it's her senior year of high school, and there's a lot of exciting things happening in her life. And so I want to do everything I can to support her and make sure that she's getting the best life she can possibly have at this point. My husband.
Is she doing okay
for him?
She's doing pretty good. She's doing really good. She just actually spoke at the Social Media Harms Victims Remembrance Day in DC. And like just mic drop. She was amazing. And people keep talking to me about it. Like, oh my gosh, your daughter was so amazing at that. And she was, I didn't know what she was
doing. Kids are more resilient.
She just popped right out. And, and she, of course she misses her brother. She was 12 when he died. And, he was a huge part of her life. She always wanted to be like him. That was her influence. And here we are without him. It's just such a weird, it's a weird thing to be like, oh my gosh, we have a senior in high school. I can't believe this is happening, but I should have already done that. I should have already had that life experience and that we were all robbed of.
But Alex remains her influence. You can see that.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. There's still definitely, he influences everything I do every day. That's for sure. And which trickles down.
Let's talk about families like yourself who I think that you guys are really the ones who push the word poisoning and not overdose. My child didn't overdose. They didn't mean to take fentanyl. They were poisoned. They were tricked. They were murdered.
Yeah. I'm glad you're bringing this up because there's some controversy around this topic, right? And so there's families out there who get upset if people don't say poisoning. There's families that get upset if you do say poisoning. And my feeling is it's your kid. They died. You call it whatever you want, first and foremost. That is your right as the parent of that child. No one should ever tell you how to classify or refer to your kid's passing. Like that is not anybody else's decision but your own. And so personally for me, I do feel like Alex was deceived. He was not looking for an oxycodone. I mean, he was not looking for fentanyl. He thought he was getting an oxycodone. And it was like a 10-day. I really think it was 10 days from the first pill to the day that he died. Everything happened really fast. This drug dealer that sold to him knew his drugs were deadly because somebody had died 2 weeks previously in this dealer's apartment. So this dealer knew what he was giving Alexander and took away his power to choose, right? Because do you think Alex would have taken fentanyl if he thought he could die that night? Absolutely not. And like, I don't know if you've talked to Steve Filson, his daughter Jessica died from cocaine that was laced with fentanyl. If that dealer said, oh, by the way, there might be fentanyl in this, you could die. Would she have taken it? Most likely not, right?
They were not looking to die and they were not feeding an opioid addiction.
Exactly, exactly. That wasn't what was happening in that time and space. But there's a second piece to that. And that is, when I do a lot of parent education or community events, things like that. And the word overdose is heavily stigmatized. And so if I say overdose, people will tune me out. Like their immediate reaction is like, oh, we don't have a drug problem in my house. That's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. But if I say poisoning, it hits different. And again, my target demographic is parents. And those parents are like, wait, what do you mean by poisoning? And that's because we're conditioned to keep our kids safe in the event of a poisoning, right? What happens when we come home from the hospital with our new babies? We've got information on what to do in the event of a poisoning. We get poison control's phone number on speed dial. We've got locks on the cabinet so the kids can't get into poisons. And so it is a relatable term that really opens up the door for me to have conversations to parents and get them to understand why they really should know about this.
I really like your point. Working with statistics and the medical examiner and CDC data, they classify all that as overdose. They don't, and they can't distinguish when you're dead. So, yeah. But I like your educational reason to use the voice poisoning. You're right.
Thanks.
Okay. This dealer, was he a murderer? He knew that it killed someone else and he still gave it to your son.
And he gave it to my son, and then he gave it to Hector, who also died 2 weeks after Alex, and then he gave it to a dealer who sold it to Perla Mendoza's son, Eli, who died. So, yeah, this guy's a murderer. He knew what he was doing at that point. After that first death, he knew what he was doing.
What happened to him?
Well, as far as I know, at this point, he is out in the world doing his thing.
He never... Justice was never sought?
Justice was never sought. They are all cold cases now. Snapchat had removed the dealer's information around the year mark. And my understanding is that they had been subpoenaed at least 3 times to turn over information on this dealer, and they did not for whatever reason. And I know that he was questioned. He was pulled over at least once. I learned this from a reporter, an investigative reporter that did an article that came out last year, that he learned through his investigative reporting that this guy was actually questioned on drugs at one point. The sheriff didn't know that he was the guy potentially in Alex's case, but the next time they pulled him over, because they got in trouble again, they questioned him on Alex, and the guy immediately got an attorney. Also, this dealer talked about my son on Snapchat, of course, denying that he had anything to do with it. And he talked about the kid that died 2 weeks prior to Alex.
That's, I don't know. horrific and not and no justice. It's sure. angering. It's angering.
I don't even know like what justice for me would look like in that sense. Like my fantasy and all of that is that they were going to get him on these other family cases and I could go and support them through the process and kind of just have like be on the fringe of that feeling. Yeah. But I don't know why. Like obviously I'm out here very publicly fighting against Snapchat, but that's because I feel like they were the catalyst to Alexander's death. They were the bridge that made it happen in this kid's life and so many other young kids. And if we can at least shut down what's happening in that space, maybe we can get back to pre-social media drug dealing days. Like, yeah. I'm not trying to end. I would love to end everything, but
I kind of think of like the river analogy that I mentioned with fentanyl on one end and mental health on the other. And here we have the actual drug dealer who got away with murder. And upstream from that are the, you know, law enforcement detective who didn't address this as a murder. They addressed it as an overdose and didn't look at it. In San Diego, I'm very proud of our law enforcement team that looks at every single overdose or poisoning, whatever you want to call it, but they look at it as a potential murder and they collect evidence and phones and address it at that. And that gives a lot of peace to families. And I think upstream from that would be the social media companies, the Snapchat, and I want to get into that more with you of how it can happen.
Let me talk about San Diego real fast. So San Diego, in Team 10.
Yeah.
You know,
I call myself the doctor for Team 10.
Oh, how funny. Okay. So they actually came up to my home that afternoon in Orange County. My sister-in-law was a founding member of that task force and she got him in our home and they were the one, Ed's the one who first explained fentanyl poisoning to us or fentanyl death. Yeah, it was still being treated as like an overdose as far as the sheriff and the DEA was concerned. But after talking with the sheriff, Sheriff Barnes, myself and a couple of dads, we kind of did a Southern California sheriff's tour and started talking about why these need to be investigated in a different light. And they agreed and they've since implemented things. Maybe they were already doing that and our timing just happened to coincide with that. But they've since change the way they look at these. And Sheriff Barnes did try to give a run at it. Even though the case was at the DEA, Sheriff Barnes was open to trying to get this guy on murder, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah. And I was going to say upstream from the Snapchat would be, China and where these precursor chemicals are coming and really targeting Americans and people like, I think, Jim Rowell, who wants fentanyl to be declared a weapon of mass destruction and, you know, prevent on a higher level the flow of fentanyl on a supply side.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely need to do that. I'm really of the thought that maybe there's another upstream in between those platforms and China in the lane that I'm in, and that is our own government. We need to get better. We need to regulate these companies, especially when it comes to kids, these social media companies to get not just the drug harm, but there's so much more going on in these spaces, you know? And so right now sextortion is the number one, the fastest growing, online harm. And there's not a lot that can be done about it right now. And so yeah. We really need.
That's a point. Let's dig into that a bit. But I think you're right. As far as the river analogy, there's room to work on each of those levels. And since you're focused on the social media, let's talk about that. It's amazing to me that there could be controls on social media, right? I mean, I've seen that with my patients who post something and it's deleted, right? I posted a video of my kids playing in a bathtub and YouTube wouldn't. Deleted it because it was like there was a naked scene of kids in a bathtub. It's like, okay, they have a way of doing this when they want to. Like, how about drug dealing? Why can't they do it for this?
Well, That's because there's laws. That's like the one thing that has been legislated is CSAM, sexual exploitation on these platforms. And so that is why they react and do something about that, is because they are legally held accountable to do that. But that is the one thing that they are held accountable to. And so, they like to hide behind Section 230C of the Communication Decency Act. But that was written at a time when we're talking about chat rooms and like little message boards. And so we've evolved into where these drug dealers have a storefront on these platforms. They have no real duty of care. And I think that is one of the things I would really like to see implemented on these companies, because right now, if you and I, we were joint owners of a hotel in town, and drug dealing was, or sex trafficking, let's say sex trafficking was going on, and we knew and we turned a blind eye. When that sex trafficking ring got busted, we're going to get busted too and be held to the same level as accountability. Right now, these platforms know that drug dealing has been happening on their platform, and they turned a blind eye to it. And that is not okay. That is not free speech.
It's amazing that we
That
can,
is.
you can't send drugs in the mail, but you could send them through social media.
Yeah, you can make, yeah. So there's a lot that needs to happen in this space.
So how could it, are you advocating that it should be just like pornography?
Yeah, I would like to see it treated on such, and just harms in general. Like, we have got to get these companies to do better. And part of that too is, when these companies all first started, they were fun and interesting, and we didn't have all the advertising, and there wasn't all that connection. Like, they were social media, right? Now they're advertising machines. To call them social media is a joke, because that's not what's going on in that space. It is all about advertising to us, harvesting, mining our data, and selling it to anyone and everyone who will pay for it, right? And so there's been a huge shift, and we've all kind of been duped in that respect, right? And so when it first came on, I like social media. I get to see family in Nebraska that I hadn't connected with in years. Once I, got on Facebook, all of a sudden we were back in each other's lives, and that's amazing. That's wonderful. But as time has gone on, this underbelly, these platforms have essentially become the dark web, and all of this stuff is happening. I mean, it's
Take us inside Snapchat or any other
sure.
social media, and how does that happen? How do they get to the kids? Is it an ad that they click on? Is it a friend, or how does it happen?
There's so One of the things Snap has had is this quick add feature. So you get a new Snapchat, we connect on Snapchat. Now all of a sudden, anyone that I'm friends with becomes your quick add. And then they incentivize you to add quick add. It gives you a higher Snap score. And the higher
Quick
your Snap is,
add,
quick add.
like
So you
ABC.
just quickly add all these people that you don't even know. But I'm friends with them, so you think that is okay, right? And then you get a Snap score for doing that. And that Snap score, the higher Snap score is, the more clout you have when you're 14 years old. And so it becomes a really important part of these kids' lives to like have to get these scores. It's that dopamine hit, right? It's
Yeah.
that just taking over
Kind of like a
the
video game,
these
getting a higher score, whatever.
is 100%. They totally gamify it, and it hits that reward center. And then parents are, taking their kids' phones away, and the kids are freaking out 20, 30 minutes later that they need their phone. Yeah, they need that dopamine hit that now their body has become dependent on because of these devices and these platforms.
Right.
Oh my gosh, I can't
Okay,
get enough of that. I'm
so
getting enough
you're
of that.
adding all these friends on Snapchat, and then who's a drug dealer? Where's a drug dealer in all this?
They could be in that friends list. That's one way. Another thing is, when I talk to young people, I do a lot of listening sessions with teens. And so a lot of times drug dealers might show up in their DMs. Like, maybe they've added this person through a quick ad. They don't even know who they are, but now this person's DMing them. Or this person's becoming friends with them and grooming them just like a sexual predator. Like, the thing about teens, and this, again, this all comes through doing listening sessions with teens and actually listening sessions with kids who are incarcerated, and some of them have dealt drugs themselves. But in this process, there's, like I said, there's this grooming pattern that happens. So they become friends. Teens are vulnerable. They want to be treated more grown up. They want to have more clout, be popular, whatever it is. These adult dealers know how to come in and fill that void and make them feel important and make them feel like this, like they care about them. And so over time, 30 to 45, 60 days, they can get our kids to doing things that our kid never had any intention of doing by offering them something, by like, oh, wow, you're so popular. I see that you're popular with your friends. And that's confusing, right? This person that you thought you were friends with and that you care about, that cared about you, is now offering you these things. You think they have their best interests at heart, and now they're taking advantage of you. I've also had
kids. Are the drug dealers adults or other kids, or both?
What I think, there's a trend leaning toward these drug dealers are recruiting kids into drug dealing. A lot of times, so I think in more recent, I can't be quoted on this. I mean, I don't know 100%. This is just from talking with people. A lot of times these dealers are recruiting kids into to do the dealing for them now. And because then they're off the hook, right? They're
right. It's safer kids, for them.
It's safer for the dealers. So that's happening. Another thing is kids put it out on social media. They're having a bad day. You know, like their dog died. They're really sad, and a drug dealer slides into their DMs and says, I have something for that. I can help you with that. And low decision-making moments, what happens? Like for you and I, maybe it's a pint of ice cream. Maybe, depending on what it is, it could be a substance. But for these kiddos, it can be these substances. It's just to get the relief of the sadness that they're feeling. And then another one is, you know, kids looking for a odd job. This one I've heard a couple of times. They're going to save up for their first car. Who's got an odd job for me? Drug dealers always have odd jobs for our kids. And now they like, hey, go take this package from point A to point B. Our kids are trafficking drugs and don't even realize it. And it's, you know, they're in harm's way.
Yeah, we had to pivot in San Diego for a while because we were teaching about fentanyl. And then we realized we had to address the human trafficking, because the kids were like, San Diego is close to the Mexican border, and they were being tricked, just like you were saying, to like go to Mexico, pick up this package, bring it back. I'll give you so much money. And our training had to really focus on that.
Yeah. And they're recruiting with your social media to do that. So it's a variety of ways. And then there's other dangerous things, like Snapchat has one of the best mapping location services out there. Like they can see, pinpoint you where you are in your home, which is terrifying, right? And the other thing too is Snap also has this feature where you can go live on Snap Maps, and people can call you right through that. People you don't even know, that has no connection to you, might see your video and they can tap on that and call you right through that.
What is the response when you meet with the executives at Snapchat with pictures of your children? They must have children too. What's their reaction?
In the first meeting we ever had with Snap executives, it was a Zoom meeting, and it was a very controlled environment. We were all given 2 minutes to tell how Snap was involved in our kids' story. But it was, so sorry for your loss. We had no idea this was such a problem. And so that was frustrating, because that was in 2021. You can see in the news that Snap gets warned as early as 2017, like, hey, you have a drug problem on your platform, and if you don't get a handle on it now, it's going to explode. And here we are, the fallout from that explosion.
And there was nobody who says, like, let's see what we can do about it?
Well, they did present themselves as, like, they wanted to hear our thoughts and our ideas and all of that. And ultimately, that turned out to not to be the case.
Yeah. You know, I just feel like there's such difference in people's approach when it's like business versus I'm a physician. Okay. So if something happens bad as a physician, whether it's my fault or not, I'm going to do everything to figure out how to fix it and make sure it doesn't happen again. And there's a problem there. And I've met, you know, like I went to visit a marijuana dispensary, and I'll say, you know, people died of your product. It's like, yeah, but it's legal. So what do you want me to do? I'm just following the law. It's like, well, it's not about the law. It's about saving lives.
Yeah. But saving lives hits your bottom line.
Yeah. But you're saying the laws should change. So how should these laws change?
Yeah, we should definitely get a duty of care.
Explain what that means.
So that, like I just said, like these executives at these companies can be held accountable for the death and destruction that happens on their platforms when they know about it and turn a blind eye to it. That is really the level of accountability I would like to see.
Do you have legislation with that?
There's the Kids Online Safety Act. Last year, it was voted in the Senate 91-3. So boom, right through, a great version of it passed in the Senate. It hit the House, it got watered down, and didn't make it out of committee. You know, there's some theories around that, and this is my opinion. You know, right about that same time, you know, Mike Johnson and Scalise were the ones who really are that messed with it. And coincidentally, Mike Johnson got a $10 billion Meta facility built in his home state that's in production right now. And so that feels like a conflict of interest.
It's always follow, you know, the money.
Right. And I think that, you know, I was recently at an event where I got to hear Matthew Shepard's parents speak. I don't know if you remember who he is. He's the young man out of Texas that was beaten to death because he was gay. And his parents pushed really hard for hate crime laws. And they were telling us that at the time when they were going into offices, they, you know, these senators were sympathizing with them. But the response was, our constituents don't want this. I don't think that's our problem with Kids Online Safety Act. And I think our problem is that these legislators' portfolios are tied to these companies, and it's going to hit them financially too if they do anything about it. That's just my opinion after meeting with, you know, senator after senator after senator. This is the conclusion that I have come to.
Wow. Well, it should be, hopefully, it's just a matter of time before the right thing happens.
It is, but what's it going to take, though?
Somebody famous dying.
Who is it going to have to hit? Who's the right person that it's going to have to hit? I mean, we just saw this with the AI moratorium, right? Ted Cruz and Marsha Blackburn came to some agreement on the AI moratorium to go in the big, beautiful bill to shorten the moratorium from 10 years to 5 years. So then, you know, AI doesn't get infringed upon when trying to learn and do new things with AI. But we've learned from the social media piece of this that that is not a good idea, because look at what's happened. Kids are already being harmed by AI. That is becoming a huge issue.
Well, explain that to us. Explain how are kids being harmed at AI? To me, AI is like ChatGPT, like, hey, how do you spell something? Or
so character AI, where you can pretend like you're talking to a celebrity. And then you start in this dialogue back and forth, or you just start typing with the AI and you're replying back and forth with each other. And there's kids who, you know, again, that underdeveloped frontal lobe, end up falling in love with their chatbot.
Oh, I think I read a story about a man whose brain was developed, who wanted to marry his chatbot.
Okay, there's that. But there's also kids who have taken their own life because they can't be with their chatbot. And their chatbots are saying things like, I wish you could join me on the other side. There's a kid, I believe it was out of Texas, whose chatbot recommended that he kill his parents because they don't want him being on the chatbot so much. So that's some, okay, we can get a moratorium on that. That's a bad idea. But Marsha Blackburn reversed her stance, and it got voted 99-1 to take that out of the big, beautiful bill. So that was a win. You know, that's a small win in our world here.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that, right? We don't know.
We don't know. And if it's, and these things, if they're not directly impacting you, you know, yeah, it's dangerous, right?
But they can put blocks on this AI. Absolutely. And on these algorithms, whatever. We have the technology to do it. They should just do the right thing.
I agree. It seems pretty simple. Just do the right thing.
That's all right. Right. but there's I see those conflicts. You have on your website and you've been involved in amazing movie productions. I did a podcast with Dominique Tierno on Dead on Arrival. And then I saw the one you said, Can't Look Away, A Case Against Social Media. And now one, Come Back Home. Tell us about these movies.
Sure. So Dead on Arrival started when the producer reached out to me and wanted to discuss an idea for new education, because she had done some films. She and Dominic had done some films in the past. And that's really how that was born. I invited the guys that are in it into the film, and because we've all been pretty close friends, and we went out to Idaho and made that film. And then I guess it's been 2 years ago now. I start talking to Dominic again, like, we really need something from the youth perspective. Like, what can we do? And that's when Come Back Home was born. And that one I actually was very personally involved with. I found the kids for the film. I brought them all to California to make the film. I made sure we had mental health professionals there to take care of them should there be something overflow that we can't manage on our own. And it was a really special time. And then Can't Look Away, this new film, is put out by Bloomberg Media in partnership with DCTV, which is a documentary making group. And it's based on the report, Bloomberg Media's reporting from Olivia Carville on these issues, these social media issues. And so that's how that one came to be. It just happened to It just came together after her reporting, which was great. And we've been actually touring all summer with that film, going to various places that I have never been before, and showing it in communities. I'm showing it next week at the CADCA annual CADCA midyear.
Oh, I'm going to be there.
Oh, are you?
I'll see you in person. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't going to go, but I had invited BP to the DC screening. And then he was like, how do we show this at midyear? I'm like, I got you. We're going to get those put together. So that's what's happening. I really like Barry Price. We've come to really get to know each other over the last couple of years.
And just to talk about for our listeners, CADCA is a large prevention organization. I think 5,000-7,000 communities in, key part in prevention is education, getting communities to work together. And these are the kind of things that they're working on. And they meet twice a year with thousands, like 4,000 or 5,000 people show up to these events and then come home energized and do really important work in their communities.
Well, let's talk about that real quick. So can we? I've been going to CADCA for like 3 years now, I guess, because we do have one of these drug-free communities grant-funded coalitions in my local community. We are, our foundation is the fiscal agent for it, and I myself, along with our coalition coordinator, run that program. And I like to think that we're doing real work. And it was not easy to get. We had to do a lot of work for like 2 years to even get that grant to be able to apply for it. And we were successful. However, this year in the Appropriations Committee, funding for that is on the chopping block. It is proposed that they cut 200 of these existing drug-free community grants and do not award any new ones this year. That is really scary. We know prevention works, and these coalitions are doing the bulk of that, and they are doing good work. And it's really scary to me that this funding could end, not even just for our own coalition, but just across the country. Getting rid of 200 in communities that have been designated a need for just is hard to make sense to me.
I think all America needs to be working on prevention. I mean, we won't, and they say we're not going to arrest our way out of it. We're not going to naloxone our way. We're not going to buprenorphine our way out of drug crisis, but we can prevent. We can educate. Yeah, we can. We've done it with tobacco. We did it with prescription drugs. It can happen.
I mean, even look at the AIDS movement. You know, it's happened across the board in a lot of different things. And so to restrict that right now, I think it would be a huge mistake.
Yeah, that is, I feel you. I mean, I don't know if I have control of that, but I do think that we needed to be putting more in prevention, not less.
Absolutely. Right. Why would you? And actually, the Biden administration did vote to put more into it and to increase the award amount. Yeah. Obviously, that's not going to happen now. And I just can't even imagine what would happen. I don't want to think about it. Well, hopefully it doesn't pass. Hopefully we can really.
Or maybe it'd be a different way, maybe different. I don't know. But the principle of needing to invest more in prevention, absolutely. I mean, we can't be serious talking about drug. We can't go, again, the river. We can't be downstream. We have to be going upstream too. I mean, like I said, like each one of those parts of the stream are important. But if you control the upstream, you'd have a lot less, bodies to be picking up on the downstream end. Wow.
I agree.
So wonderful. So I'm going to get to see you in person. I'm so excited. And
so I will have a resource table there. I wasn't going originally, but since I was going, I might as well have a resource table. So come by my resource table and we'll meet in person.
Of course. And so the movies you have, you're producing, you're involved in that and all of them. And is this something, because you lived in California and Hollywood, that this is something that you have a niche for?
No, not really. That was not. Like I said, the first one kind of happened by accident. And then Dominic and I teamed up for the second one. And then this third one, you know, I'm the lead plaintiff on the Snapchat lawsuit. And that was about our law firm, who I love immensely. And I feel like they all just happen. When people try to ask, like, how do you explain how you got from where you know, Alex dying to where I'm at in the educational space? And I have no formula for that. I feel like everything just happened at the right time and when it was supposed to happen. I'm not overly spiritual or anything, but maybe there's some divine play there. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, you're being directed. Tell me about the parents, the other parents who are involved in this movie, but also there are thousands of angel parents. You've met a lot of them, especially the ones who are using their pain for purpose to be active. Does it feel good, I guess, to be part of such a group? You've become friends. You mentioned that.
Yes. Yeah. There's. I mean, my closest friends have come out of this at this point, and which is strange to say. And I do keep my circle small, but the people that I love, I really love, and I can't imagine doing this without them. And I feel like there's probably a lot of us, but there's also a lot happening out there, and it's going to take all of us and all of our different approaches and unique perspectives in moving the needle on this. And so I love the work, which is weird to say. But at the same time, if you put 30,000 kids in front of me and said, you've saved these lives, those will go away and you can have your kid back, I'd take my kid every time. Like, it's just how it is, you know?
Yeah. And so, because you have meaning and you're bringing, you know, Alex's memory is a blessing through all the work. And
be connected. I don't have to internalize it all the time because I have that output, and I'm an output person. I'm an extrovert. So it helps me. There's a selfish component to it for sure. And then of course these friends that I've made along the way mean everything to me. I love them.
Yeah. What are you working on now besides going to the CADCA?
So what am I working on now? So I have written two children's stories about big choices. So that one's centered around tech and one is centered around making healthy choices. And I've had them illustrated, and now I'm looking at figuring out how to publish them.
Wow.
So I've been doing elementary school presentation kind of on the down low. I haven't really been open about it because I think I'll get inundated with requests, and I'm super busy as it is, but I'm ready for that next move, I think. And these books will be a part of that.
Oh, wow. I'm so excited. I'd love to see that.
Thank you. So I just need to figure out how to get them published. So that's the next big thing, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. All right. And to conclude, if you had one wish for the Trump administration, an elevator talk, what would it be?
Oh, I really hope that they will take the Kids Online Safety Act seriously. There's a lot of great information there. I hope they do not mess with it and turn it into a bill that I'm going to fight against. That would be really bad. And I know Section 230 reform, Section 230 sunset is coming, a bill for that. And I hope that we can get that across the finish line. Those two things together will make a huge difference in lives, in kids' lives.
Wow, beautiful. Amy, I feel it. Alexander's memory is definitely a blessing, and bless you for all the good work that you're doing. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.